Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We welcome Judge Robert Miller of the Northern District of Indiana, who's sitting with the Court of Appeals today. Our first argument this morning is Hooper against Ryan. Mr. Bob.
May it please the Court, Counsel, Nathaniel Love for Petitioner Appellant Murray Hooper. I'd like to focus on the Batson claim. The Illinois Court's finding of no prima facie case of intentional discrimination on this record was an unreasonable application of Batson. The state struck all eligible black jurors.
Counsel, why does it matter whether there's a prima facie case? If I understand correctly, the role of prima facie cases here and in Title VII is to determine whether there will be a hearing. But there's been a hearing. The Supreme Court said, certainly for Title VII cases, that once there's a hearing or a trial, the whole apparatus of prima facie cases and responses just goes away. Why isn't that equally true for Batson?
Well, I think that's correct, Your Honor, but for the purposes of reviewing the decision that was made below, both Maloney and the Illinois Supreme Court purported to be deciding this issue at the prima facie stage.
But they also decided that there was no race discrimination. My question is, who gives a fig anymore about prima facie cases? Why don't we just figure out whether it was an incorrect or clearly erroneous finding of fact to find that there was no discrimination? That seems to be the dulling question.
I agree with you, Judge Easterbrook, and I believe that's where the court should end up in this case, is evaluating that question. But part of the problem is dealing with 2254D and determining whether or not what the state courts did was an unreasonable application of Batson or involved clearly erroneous findings of fact.
I can't stop you from arguing about this, but if the state court had said someplace along the line that water boils at 50 degrees Celsius, that would be unreasonable and wrong, but it wouldn't have anything to do with the outcome. And I hope we wouldn't be here arguing about it.
I agree with you, Judge Easterbrook, and I think if you look at the hearing that took place and the fact that reasons were offered, those reasons were discussed, and then you've got a decision coming out the other end, I think the decision is clearly wrong because the justifications that were offered are pretextual. And the facts, the inconsistencies between those reasons and the record were demonstrated by Hooper at the Batson hearing, and they were simply ignored by the Illinois Supreme Court and by Maloney.
Would you agree, counsel, that as to prospective juror Nelson, as to whom the state never offered any explanation, if I recall correctly, the transcript of the Batson hearing that was held, there were numerous invitations and opportunities to provide an explanation if one was available.
That's absolutely correct. I believe it's 143 to 144 of the appendix is this exchange where Maloney effectively asks, well, the state actually asks first. It said there were, the state was discussing the strike of Juror Nelson with Maloney, and the state claimed there were non-discriminatory reasons for its challenges that were not offered by the prosecutor but were clearly reflected in the record. That's what the state claimed. And then Mr. Stock asked Maloney if Maloney wanted the state to go into those reasons. Maloney answered yes and asked the state to give its full answer to Hooper's position. The state immediately backs off. It claims it doesn't believe Hooper's established a prima facie case, so it doesn't have to introduce these reasons, whatever they were, and it never has.
But it was fairly clear that Judge Maloney thought that whatever record had to be made had been made. He listened to both lawyers forever, right?
Mm-hmm. He did. He did. There was a long hearing. That's certainly true. So a little bit more, though, with respect to Nelson's strike. I mean, as for Nelson in particular, there's nothing in the record that could plausibly be a justification for a strike. She was 59. She owned her own home. She owned her own home for nearly two decades. She had no hesitation about the death penalty. She had prior jury service. And her granddaughter, at the time of the trial, her granddaughter had just married a Chicago police officer. Save for that last attribute, she's indistinguishable from other jurors, in particular Margaret Bolin, who survived seven rounds of the strikes by the prosecution and served on the jury. There's nothing in the record that could provide some clear reason why Minnie Nelson was struck. And as for the four explanations for the four other strikes, I think Maloney's analysis of Cynthia Miller's strike perhaps best exemplifies what went wrong and why his Batson determination is wholly unreasonable. During jury selection, in response to Hooper's first objection to the state strikes, the state claimed that Miller's home in Chicago was close to where Hooper's co-defendant Roger Collins lived, that she lived in an area frequented by Roger Collins' gang, and at the Batson hearing, the state relied on those same justifications. The problem with that is there is absolutely nothing in the record that supports it. There are three Chicago addresses for Roger Collins in the record, the closest of which is just shy of 4 miles from Miller's home. She lived in the 8600 block of South Euclid. You can see in the map on page 35 of her opening brief, she lived in the Calumet Heights neighborhood. That's east of Stony Island. It's close to the Skyway Toll Plaza.
Let me understand what we do with that at this point in the proceeding. Certainly, if somebody exercises a peremptory based on some non-racial grounds, but is mistaken as to those non-racial grounds, what do we do with that?
I think the reason is clearly a pretext. I mean, they're offering a reason. They're claiming, oh, no, we didn't strike her because she's black. We struck her because she lived too close to the co-defendant and the gang. But the issue as to what the addresses were, that was presented at the Batson hearing. And Maloney simply ignored it, and he changed the prosecution's reason, got rid of the Collins addresses. Once Hooper's counsel told him there's three addresses for Roger Collins, none of them are near, the closest is 4 miles away, you'll see on the record that he claims, well, that wasn't their reason at all. That's simply not true. The words that came out of the prosecutor's mouth were, she lives close to Roger Collins. He lives close to her home. And that's the reason we're going to strike her. It's simply not true. It's a pretext, and the only plausible inference to draw is the reason she was struck is because she was black. In affirming Maloney's ruling, the Illinois Supreme Court wrote that striking a juror because of geographical proximity to a co-defendant's home or the scene of the crime could be a race-neutral reason. That's certainly true in the abstract, but it has nothing to do with this case because there's nothing in the record to support that claim. It's simply not true. And this isn't something that came up after the fact. It's something that was before Maloney at the time.
But that was, just so I understand where we are in that, that was at the Batson hearing, not at the time of the peremptories. Nobody called that to the prosecutor's attention during the trial itself. Is that right?
That's correct. It was the discrepancy with the addresses was something at the Batson hearing. Okay. But the reason that she lived close to Roger Collins, that was articulated at the Batson hearing. I'm sorry, at the jury selection initially. I'd also like to discuss Willa Austin. Again, the Illinois Supreme Court accepted without analysis the state's justification for striking Austin, that because of strikes that Hooper had exercised, the state had to restore gender balance. The claim was Hooper had knocked out all of the men, and the makeup of the jury was entirely changed. Problem again is those contentions can't survive scrutiny. What happened at jury selection was after several dismissals for cause, the state got a panel of 12 jurors. It contained 10 women and only 2 men. Now, over 2 rounds, the state exercised 4 strikes. They struck 2 men and 2 women. 3 of those people were black. They finally accepted a panel then that had 11 women and 1 man. So the state, over the course of its first round of strikes, shifted the gender balance from 10 to 2, 11 to 1, by 1 juror in favor of women. The panel passed to Hooper. Hooper exercised several rounds of strikes. And the panel he tendered back to the state had 12 women on it. Shifted the gender balance by 1 in favor of women, exactly the same margin and exactly the same direction as the state had. The makeup of the jury had not been entirely changed. Hooper had not knocked out all of the men. That was the state of the panel that Hooper got, and shift by 1 exactly as the state had. Even if that reason, this gender-shifting reason, were initially considered plausible, at the point the state struck Austin, every other juror on that panel was a woman. They were all women. So if the state were simply choosing women randomly in an effort to shift the gender balance, it had less than a 5% chance of randomly striking both Willa Austin and Tripp T. Eroy, the only other dark-skinned woman on the panel. And the third person they strike was Arlene Francone at the same time. She had said although she might have trouble with the death penalty, she would consider it. Any contention that what the state was doing was just simply picking 3 women to shift the gender balance is completely implausible. These were not a random selection. They picked the only 2 dark-skinned women and the one who said she might have trouble with the death penalty.
Mr. Love, could I ask you to help us clarify the numbers here?
Sure.
We're going to be talking at some point about the Illinois Supreme Court's statements that the use of peremptories against black prospective jurors was not disproportionate, but I want to make sure we get the math right.
Yes.
If I understand this correctly, the right number we need to look for is the total number of jurors not struck for cause.
Correct. Right.
And that is how many?
There were 22 excusals for cause on the first day, so that's 36 potential jurors.
Okay.
So what is reflected in the record is that there were two black jurors who were struck for cause. So there's the five strikes that we have at issue here. So 5 out of 36 is just shy of 14%. If you look at the total composition of the veneer, it's about 12%.
Okay, but let's just take folks left after challenges for cause.
Right.
From We're just talking about 36, that's all?
From the first panel, it's 36 jurors.
Okay.
It's a bit confusing when you look at the transcript because Judge Maloney refers to 60 jurors. If you go through and count names, you get 58.
Okay.
If you count names extremely carefully, I found a 59th, and I apologize, that's not in the brief. It's from the clerk calling out names to move people into the box. There's a Eugene Yagoza that shows up. He never gets voir dired, so I don't know if he slipped out at some point. But it's 58 jurors. 22 excusals for cause leaves you 36 from the first panel.
And are those, in your view, the right numbers to look at?
I believe those are the right numbers to look at. What happened is they ran out of jurors on that first day. There was a second day. 9 people came through. 2 were excused for cause. 7 were either ended up on the jury or were stricken. There's nothing in the record that indicates any of those individuals were black. So if you add those in, what's going to happen to that percentage, that 5 out of 36, you're going to add 7 to that, it's going to drop down a little bit, it's going to be back close to 12% again in terms of what's the composition of the jurors that were under consideration.
Okay, thank you.
So if you look at the state's brief and how the state attempts to defend the Illinois Supreme Court's decision as reasonable, they list these factors that the court considered. One of those factors is that explanations were given for 4 out of 5 strikes, and we've discussed several of those. We've discussed the absence of a strike for Minnie Nelson. That's not a factor that weighs against a prima facie case because the reasons are pretexts. There's a missing reason. If you go back to the state's list on page 21 of its brief, related to this disproportionate inquiry, they list that an unusually small number of blacks were in the jury pool and that the prosecution struck more white than black veneer members. And as you were saying, Judge Hamilton, the relevant question is what's the rate of strikes as compared to the composition of the veneer, or if you like, the composition of the people who are not excused for cause. If blacks represented a small percentage of the veneer, then they should represent a correspondingly small percentage of the strikes. But the numbers here are just the opposite. The state struck black jurors at a rate 3 times the representation of the veneer, and that's true even if you're talking about the number of the composition of the people who are not strict for cause. 45% of the strikes were against black jurors. Only 12 to 14% the jurors. That weighs in favor of a prima facie case. This observation...
You say that strikes exercised without racial discrimination should mirror the number originally in the pool. What's the basis for that? Has anybody done a statistical analysis? You have a professional statistician analyze these, or anybody do a regression equation? There are two kinds of questions here. One is, if all challenges are done at random, in what percentage of the situations will X percent of black jurors get struck? That's just a question of doing elementary statistics. Has that ever been done here?
No, not on this record.
The second is, if you adjust for such things as felony convictions, right, pare down the pool, then do the study. Well, if it's never been done at all, you wouldn't be able to adjust for it.
Right.
But I worry in cases, statisticians refer to the law of large numbers. When you've got very large numbers, you expect things to come out in proportion. But we aren't dealing with a large number case here. Neither the size of the veneer nor the number of strikes is a large number statistically.
Right.
Well, I wonder whether somebody's done some analysis.
No, I think that's a good question. I mean, part of the problem you have with the law of large numbers is it's difficult to get a panel that's really big enough to be
exactly.
to be large in the way that...
So you need a statistical analysis of what is the probability that if all of these were done by chance and you re-ran it, say, 1,000 times. It's easy to do this in a computer simulation. They're called Monte Carlo simulations. If you re-ran it 1,000 times, how many times would it look like what actually happened here? And then you could compute the probability of that.
Right. Well, the one probability that I did throw into the brief is that less than 5% for randomly striking Austin and Tripti Eroy. I think doing it on the overall composition of the panel, you might get answers. The other problem that's going to be in there, Judge Easterbrook, is if there are reasons that are accepted as legitimate, if you take there might be disparate impact on particular racial groups, even though the reasons for strikes could be viewed as legitimate. But if you look at this record, there's nothing to indicate that these five jurors had anything that would justify, at least uniformly, that would justify the strikes of all five jurors based on what was known about them through the voir dire. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve my time.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Trebell.
Good morning, Your Honors. Carl Trebell with the Attorney General's Office of Illinois, representing the respondent warden. May it please the court. The state appellate court analysis of
this. Do you agree with the answer to my last question to Mr. Love? Has anybody done a Monte Carlo simulation or anything similar to test the probability of an outcome like this if all the strikes were race blind?
The answer was correct. We agree with it that there has been no analysis of that, Your Honor. And I agree that it's something that.
By the way, this litigation seems interminable. It's unbelievable how long it took the state courts to resolve this. And yet it seems neither side has done what, from a social science perspective, would be the very first step.
And that may be true, Your Honor. I'm not sure I would characterize the Batson part of it as interminable. There were multiple remands for resentencing. The Batson hearing took place, I think, a year after Batson was decided, and was decided by the Illinois Supreme Court just a couple of years later. But you're right, Your Honor.
One reason why it's so astounding, it's taken the courts of Illinois more than 20 years to finish one round of collateral review.
That's true, Your Honor, and part of the reason is because the petitioner submitted a voluminous post-conviction record, and part of the reason is because there was multiple remands for resentencing. It was a death penalty case until former Governor Ryan commuted the sentence. But to go to your point, it is defendant's burden, and the Supreme Court is clear on this, that it's defendant's burden in state court to establish a Batson violation. And if there was no social science done, if there were no statistical analysis done of the strikes, then defendant has not met his burden. And the state court's decision was a reasonable application, both of fact and law. I did want to address your first point, Judge Easterbrook, which was whether or not 2254 D1 applies here. This court applied the D1, the law part of 2254 analysis, in a case called Bennett, which was also a Batson case. So it does appear that this court's prior holdings, anyway, are that this is a mixed question of law and fact. Obviously, there are a number of factual determinations that go into the calculus, but the ultimate determination of whether or not there's a Batson violation is a legal one.
Why? How is that position consistent with Pullman's standard against Swint?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know that case.
Pullman's standard against Swint is a decision of the Supreme Court holding that the question whether discrimination occurred is an issue of fact, not a mixed anything, not a question of law. It's just a question of fact.
And that position would seem to be consistent with the way that the Supreme Court has consistently held since announcing Batson, that it defers to the state court's factual findings. As I said, in Bennett and in other cases that we cited in our brief, there are a number of courts, including the district court below, who describe it as a mixed question of law and fact.
Yeah,
maybe
but
that it's,
how is that consistent with Pullman's standard?
I don't know that it would be, Your Honor. But, of course, that standard, while it's a discrimination standard, it may be viewed differently than a Batson one. I don't know.
Well, along those lines, Mr. Trebell, the Illinois Supreme Court told us twice that the use of peremptory strikes against black jurors in this case was not disproportionate, comparing 6-5 as opposed to comparing the proportions of strikes of 100% of black jurors being struck and about 20% of white jurors being struck. You go to some considerable effort in your brief to say that that was a question of law and not fact, and I don't understand what difference it makes to you and why it's not obviously wrong either way.
I guess it's just a habit of doing so many habeas cases where 2254 applies and we need to break down 2254 D1 versus D2. And until very recently, whether or not it was apparent from the state court record would make a difference between the two. Now it seems pretty clear that you have to – the petitioner needs to show that the state court was unreasonable based on the record that was before it at the time, based on both D1 and D2. So I'll concede to you, Your Honor, it's not clear that whether you look at it under the D1 lens or the D2 lens really makes all that much of a difference. But 2254D does apply to the state court's judgment. And I think that the differences you were just illuminating point to why this is a mixed question of law and fact, because the facts are clear. The number of strikes is reflected in the record. The parties have adjudicated how many exactly of the prosecutor's strikes were black versus how many were white, and there was a couple that were, I guess you would describe them as non-white but non-black as well. One was a Filipino who served on the jury panel. One was an Indian, East Indian woman who was struck. Those are the underlying facts, and the state court, of course, got those right. The Illinois Supreme Court described them accurately. Its ultimate analysis of whether or not that establishes a Batson violation, I think, is a legal conclusion where you have to look to the law that the Supreme Court announced in Batson, which, as the Second Circuit has recognized, was not very clear when it was announced. And courts have struggled for 25 years since then to figure out, okay, exactly what does it mean to have a disproportionate number of strikes? What numbers exactly do we look at? Those are questions of law that percolated through the courts for a number of years. And I think it demonstrates that the Illinois Supreme Court's decision, at least as of 1989, was very reasonable.
How can it be reasonable to say this was not disproportionate when the prosecutor exercised the maximum number of possible strikes to remove all black jurors?
Because, Your Honor, the case law at the time was very clear that striking all of the black jurors was one factor to be considered, and it was certainly a factor that the Illinois Supreme Court discussed at length and acknowledged. But it's just one of all relevant factors that the court should consider in determining whether or not there was a Batson violation.
Sure, it's one factor. But how is that? How are these numbers not disproportionate?
And as of 1989, Your Honor, again, it wasn't clear exactly what the court meant by disproportionate. Was it referring to something like what the prosecutors had argued and what the state court relied on, where more strikes were against?
That's just nonsense, though, right? I mean, statistically, mathematically, logically, that's just nonsense.
The subsequent case law has seemed to indicate that your first questions have the current picture accurate as far as what constitutes disproportionality. You look at the overall numbers. But as Judge Easterbrook has said, there's also a statistical factor that comes into play here.
So why didn't you do the statistics, right? The claim of your adversary is essentially that the prosecutor did everything he could possibly do to remove blacks from the jury. Right. Now, the state might want to respond, we've analyzed this, and this is the kind of thing that can readily happen by chance in small numbers cases. But apparently you haven't done that.
And that's a defense that a state might make at a third stage.
But it's not a defense that you did make.
Correct, Your Honor, and this case has never gone to a third-stage Batson analysis.
I have no idea what a third-stage Batson analysis is.
Well, the first,
I know, I think, roughly what a third-degree burn is.
But the Supreme Court's announced in Batson, and I acknowledge, again, it wasn't entirely clear when it was announced, that at the third stage, the trial court makes credibility determinations on whether or not the second-stage proffered reasons for making those strikes were pretextual or not. So at that stage, the state could present evidence defending its strikes, and it's the defendant's burden to prove.
Let's go in a different direction for a moment. Hooper says that the prosecutor never gave an explanation for the strike of Juror Nelson. And I looked in your brief for a discussion of that and didn't find it. Do you have any statement about that now? A little late. It should have been in your brief. But what is your position about that?
The state acknowledges, and the Illinois Supreme Court acknowledges, that there was no reasons offered for that strike. And if this case were remanded to a second stage,
how do we determine whether the reason was honest when there was never one given? That's the critical question, right?
That's the critical question at the second and third stage. This was a first stage holding.
Let me approach this perhaps from a slightly different angle.
In your brief, Mr. Treble, you suggest that if we remand, you want a chance for another hearing. First of all, I've got to say, it seems to me pretty clear that both Maloney and the Illinois Supreme Court made and affirmed ultimate findings as to no discrimination here. The Illinois Supreme Court said the trial court found that considering all relevant circumstances, it was shown that the prosecutor did not excuse prospective jurors because of their race. That finding is affirmed. That sounds to me, you know, this is before the three-step dance, the Batson waltz, emerged in its current complex form, but all the elements are here, and it were all in that 1987 hearing and in the findings. If we, you can please feel free to convince me I'm wrong about that and tell me if we had another hearing, what would you do? What's there to be offered 26 years later?
The answer, Your Honor, is I don't know. I've got some experience with this in another case that's pending before this court, which also had a similar 30-year time frame. What Judge Kennelly did was hold a new evidentiary hearing, discuss all of the evidence that would apply to all three stages, and ask the prosecutors what their recollections were. It may be that the state's attorney on a remand proceeds in that manner. It may be that the state's attorney analyzes the record, talks to the state's attorney, the former state's attorney who tried this case in the 1980s, and decides that they cannot proceed with the second or third stage proceeding because of this fifth juror who's got no explanation on the record. But that's an issue that the state's attorney should decide after examining the facts. The record in this case does not say one way or another whether a remand would be fruitless. Your question also raised another point that I want to emphasize, which is that Batson itself said that at the first stage, the prima facie showing stage, the trial court could examine any statements on the record that were already made by the prosecutor. Well, there were statements already on the record as to four of the five witnesses, and that was part of the first stage analysis. It was not a second stage analysis or a third stage analysis. The trial court was very clear. It was just finding that there was no prima facie case, and that's what the Illinois Supreme Court stated was the question presented. That's what the parties briefed, and that decision was a reasonable application of Batson. What this court did in Coulter was remand for a new state court Batson hearing that would proceed to all three stages. And ultimately, that came back to this court, and this court found that habeas relief should not be granted in that event. So I don't know that it would be fruitless. I grant you it would be difficult, but I don't know that it would be fruitless. Either way, it's unnecessary because the state court's determination was a reasonable application along both of law
lines,
and fact.
Along those lines, Mr. Treble, I was looking in your brief for some engagement with the Supreme Court's decision in Miller L., where in the second round, and also with our recent decision in Harris against Hardy, both of which found state courts had been unreasonable in rejecting Batson challenges as a matter of fact. And frankly, the evidence there seemed less compelling than this.
And those two cases both went to all three stages of Batson analysis. What the Supreme Court has held is that at the first stage, we give a great deal of deference to the state courts. And that's what the Illinois Supreme Court did in this case. It applied that theory of law and accurately predicted that that type of deference would apply. If this were a case where the state court had gone to all three stages and the prosecutors had offered explanations and there had been credibility determinations as to all of those, perhaps some statistical socioeconomic analysis, then we would have a different record and then we would be briefing the issues that were presented in Miller L2 and in Harris. Those cases are not on point to this type of analysis, and therefore that's why we didn't address them in that brief.
The elephant in the room here is reflected by the reference to the state trial court judge, often without any honorific. Judge Maloney, we know, was corrupt. I don't know if he's still in federal prison.
I think he's passed, Your Honor. But
he's on supervised release at this point. But
Depends on your religion.
Sorry. Okay. I'm a little. I'm out of date on obituaries. I'm trying to imagine a more exceptional or extraordinary circumstance that might call into question the usual levels of deference we give to state trial courts, particularly where in the Batson hearing here, he clearly seemed to have his mind made up from the beginning that this could not possibly happen in his courtroom without his knowing it, and that there could not possibly be race discrimination in modern-day Chicago courts in 1981.
I see my time's up, Your Honor. Do you mind if I briefly answer?
Well, we're talking. You can
talk. Okay. Obviously, Your Honor, it would have been much better if another trial judge had handled this case. But the Illinois Supreme Court was unaware of his legal standing, I guess, his exploits in 1989, and it did not infect their Batson analysis. When it came back
Shouldn't
up in
it?
Front of... Well, no, because when it came back up before the state appellate court, they addressed this question of whether or not Maloney's bias had a direct impact on the Batson violation, and they found that petitioner had failed to demonstrate any sort of actual bias with a nexus, a link that connected to either the Batson hearing or the pretrial suppression hearing. That analysis tracked directly what this court and the Supreme Court had applied in case law affecting the petitioner's co-defendants in the Bracey cases. So under those circumstances, it was not unreasonable for the state court to defer to the trial court's factual findings and then on post-conviction maintain that it would continue to defer to those findings. And indeed, the district court's analysis demonstrates the reasonableness of it, because even after she said erroneously that there was a 2254 D2 violation here because of the race of the witnesses, she continued to defer to that court under a 2254A analysis.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Love?
Just wanted to respond to one point about the suggestion that there should be a renewed Batson hearing. I believe counsel was suggesting that the state's attorney should be permitted to go back and consult with the prosecutors, assuming they can find them, and ask effectively, what were your real reasons? Because the reasons you gave at the time have been shown to be pretextual. Why don't you invent some new ones and see if we can survive this challenge? I think that proposal is absurd, and I don't think any finder of fact could find those new reasons invented 31 years after jury selection to be credible. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.